I'm very excited about this morning, although I lost an hour and it's really hurting. Gosh, that alarm went off fast this morning. I always feel a little bit robbed in the spring here when we lose that hour. You forget how much an hour means. With Daryl's injury, with Liz, I've just been thinking a lot about this tapestry of life. I mean, the complexity of in our little community here. You know, everything that's going on, the complexity, the emotions, the dynamic nature of the relationships, and you know, we've got deaths and relapses and we've got marriages and births, and there's just so many things happening. It just is really, really amazing. Sometimes just to stand back and think of it all is a bit overwhelming. And then thinking about how we forge our path through all of that, all of life, the things that are happening in our own lives, in our own families, and everyone around us. And it can be kind of daunting. It can be kind of confusing. And it would be nice if one of the things that we can do in here is to establish some principles, some guides, some rules of thumb, if you will, that kind of help us to make those choices, to move us through, to answer certain questions to our satisfaction that allow us the confidence, the blessed assurance to be able to go through the things that we need to go through, the difficulties that life faces us. And so I was thinking about that this morning. I was thinking about that this week in terms of what we were going to talk about today. And I had one idea, and then someone sent me a viral video, and Marion and I watched it, and as we were talking about that, Marion says, I think this is what you should talk about. And so after watching the video and watching all the attendant comments and response videos and all this stuff, I wasn't really sure I wanted to go there anymore, but I think I'm going to wade in anyway and see what happens. A few years ago, I got an email from a man in Minnesota, I believe, somewhere back there, Minnesota or Wisconsin. And it was out of the blue, and God bless the internet. It puts you together with people that you would never in a million years connect with. And I just love that about this World Wide Web. But he was calling me, and he was taking me to task in a pretty strident way. He wanted to know what this effect was all about, and he wanted to know, you know, what I was about and what I was teaching. And I couldn't figure out from Minnesota, you know, why this guy was coming down on me this way. And so I replied to him, and we started an email correspondence that lasted 2 or 3 months. And the story came out that he has a 17-year-old son. He himself had been an elder in the church for years and a leader in the church and very disciplined about his religious practice and about his faith. And at some point in the last week or so before he sent me the email, his 17-year-old son challenged him and said, Dad, is what you believe really true, or is it just what you believe? I want you to think about that question for a minute. Is what you believe really true, or is it just what you believe? I don't think enough of us ask that question. I don't think if enough of us really look at our faith and look at what we are saying that we are believing to really find out. Is it something that we got secondhand, third hand? Is it something that we were raised in that we just move along with? Or is it something that we've really considered and taken deep into our spirit and taken the journey so that we know that we know that the things that we say we believe are true? Is it only the 17-year-olds among us that are asking such questions, you know? Or can us old folks do the same thing? Is there a time where we stop learning, or can we continue to grow and to move? This thing hit me hard. You know, he wanted to know who I was, because what happened was when he said, after they had started having a conversation based on this initial question, he said, where are you getting these ideas? And he gave him the effects website. Oh! Busted. Actually, I was proud to be part of that quest, part of that searching, part of the mix in the 17-year-old and now his father, that is asking questions and is putting logs on people's fire to be able to see what happens as they burn, you know, things that weren't considered before. And so, you know, we corresponded for another couple months, and he calmed down, and He decided I wasn't the Antichrist or anything of that nature. So anyway, I get this video yesterday or the day before from a friend in Michigan, and I guess I had my head under a media rock because I knew nothing about this. But actually, this thing was launched last January, and it has gone viral. And there's now almost, as of last night, nearly 20 million hits on this thing. And it's just insane how fast it has grown on YouTube. And I thought about playing it here this morning, but I thought, no, instead of that, let me just quote you a little bit. This thing, like I said, 20 million hits. It had 3 million hits in one day. The writer, it's actually kind of it's a poem that was sort of half spoken, half rapped. And it's a really good looking kid in a leather jacket, you know, in his 20s or something. Hails from up in Washington State. And he delivers it really well. He's got a great voice and all of that. And it's professionally produced. This thing hit, and the young people are just driving it crazy on the internet. And the title of it is Why I Hate Religion But Love Jesus. So right away it's got your attention, right? Just a few of the verses, the stanzas from it. What if I told you Jesus came to abolish religion? What if I told you voting Republican really wasn't his mission? What if I told you Republican doesn't automatically mean Christian? And just because you call some people blind doesn't automatically give you vision. I mean, if religion is so great, why has it started so many wars? Why does it build huge churches but fails to feed the poor? Tells single moms God doesn't love them if they ever had a divorce. But in the Old Testament, God actually calls religious people whores. Religion might preach grace, but another thing they practice, tend to ridicule God's people. They did it to John the Baptist. They can't fix their problems, so they just mask it, not realizing religion's like spraying perfume on a casket. See, the problem with religion is it never gets to the core. It's just behavior modification, like a long list of chores. Like, let's dress up on the outside and make look nice and neat. But it's funny that what they used to do to mummies, well, the corpse rots underneath. Now, I ain't judging. I'm just saying, quit putting on a fake look. Because there's a problem that people only know you're a Christian by your Facebook. I mean, in every other aspect of life, you know that logic's unworthy. It's like saying you play for the Lakers just because you bought a jersey. Now, back to the point. One thing is vital to mention. How Jesus and religion are on opposite spectrum. See, the one's the work of God, but one's a man-made invention. See, one is the cure, the other's the infection. See, because religion says do, Jesus says done. Religion says slave, Jesus says son. Religion puts you in bondage while Jesus sets you free. Religion makes you blind, but Jesus makes you see. And that's why religion and Jesus are two different clans. So for religion, no, I hate it. In fact, I literally resent it. Because when Jesus said it is finished, I believe he meant it. How does that make you feel? Reactions. You know, heads nodding up and down. See, young people are flocking to this for a lot of reasons. I mean, the first reason is that young people are iconoclastic anyway. They like to tear things down. They got the generation thing going on. They don't want to do things the way their parents and their forebears did it. There's that natural rebellion that's going on. But there's more to it than that. The church is in transition right now, definitely in transition. Has been in transition really since the end of World War II. And all the cultural revolutions and all the different things that we've been going through in the last 40, 50 years are not lost as soon as we walk inside the doors of the church. The church is moving, it's changing, or it needs to, if our young people are going to ever see it as relevant, if they're going to see it as speaking to them, their generation, and to the future that they behold as they look forward. It's what's going on. And so this is speaking to young people. It's provocative. It's cool. It's hip. And it's saying things in a very clever and clear way. You know, this has brought the writer of this poem to the media attention. He's now been on CBS and CNN. And these videos that were made in response, you know, probably hundreds of them by now. And the comments to the video are in the hundreds of thousands now. And so you got Catholic priests responding. You got evangelical pastors responding. You have the amazing atheist responding, which is really one of the more interesting ones, if you could get past the language. But it's really stirred up a lot of controversy. A lot of really intense feelings on both sides. And as I was going through all this, I started to get tired because, for me, as soon as we're in a debate over things that are spiritual, I feel that we've lost before we've begun. And the reason for that, it's kind of like when you go to court, you know, even if you win, you lose. And the only one who really win is the lawyers. You know, they're only ones that really win. It's kind of like that, because having a debate about theological issues presupposes that the answer to our spirituality is intellectual, that we can figure this all out, that there is a right and a wrong intellectual answer that's going to make all the difference in terms of the relationship that we have with God, or God's acceptance of us, or God's love for us. And because of that false premise, we've lost before we begun. And so all this flurry, all this division, all this separation, this name-calling. I mean, some people had to turn their comments off because the responses were so bad, so heinous. So what's going on here? And what are we supposed to do in terms of how we proceed forward? How do we deal with these things? It's not something that we can just leave aside. There's an important question being raised here, and I think it's something that we need to take a look at. So how do we deal with these particular issues in a practical way? There was a lot of debate about how this young writer is wrong theologically, and he's approaching things in a wrong way. But I want to try to stay away from those issues and more look at the core issue that he's raising. Because what he's raising is age-old. It's an age-old admonition against the avoidance of hypocrisy and corruption in the church. Hypocrisy and corruption in our religious practice. Now, to be really fair, he's saying that he hates religion, but what he's really talking about is hypocrisy. He's talking about corruption. He's talking about falseness, inauthenticity, you know. That wouldn't be as sexy to say, you know, Jesus hates hypocrisy. Jesus hates religion is something that really has teeth and traction and grabs, and he's using it as a shorthand for all those things. But words have meaning, and we got to be careful, and we need to be precise about the words that we use, I think, because we can too quickly throw the baby out with the bathwater here, and we can paint religion as something bad, something wrong. And then we can move to the other side and say, well, spirituality is supposed to be this pure thing, this individual thing, this thing that is pure relationship and has nothing to do with institution or practice or ritual or any of the things that people have been doing with each other since we were drawing on caves. And I think there's a danger there. There's something that we need to take a look at. Go a little deeper. Did Jesus really hate religion? Did Jesus, as this writer say, come to abolish religion? Was that his mission? Was that what he was trying to do? And I think we need to make a distinction, and we've often made that in here, between religion and spirituality. That's true enough. We have talked about, and I've defined religion as the expression of an experience, a corporate expression of an experience. With every religion on earth, there was someone who had an experience of the living God, an experience that so changed them, so changed profoundly their attitude and their view and their worldview of life, that as they taught it to others, they caught fire, had the same experience. And then eventually, in time, there was a way of living life as a group that grew out of that experience. Rules, if you will, for living together, that expressed that experience and the truth behind that experience. That's what religion is. And yes, it's separate from spirituality in that sense. It's a corporate expression. It's a group way of living out the truth that each one of its members needs to feel deep inside in their core. And it moves from inside to outside. But having said that, does Jesus hate or abolish religion? I want to go to Matthew 5:17, and the obvious verse there is that Jesus says, "Do not think I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish but to fulfill." Continuing on at verse 18, "For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So he didn't come to abolish the law and the prophets. Well, what's the law and the prophets? In Judaism, the law and the prophets is a shorthand for the whole body of Jewish thought, the whole body of Hebrew thought, the whole body of Hebrew and Jewish practice, religious practice. The law and the prophets literally is talking about the entire Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament. And so Jesus didn't come to abolish all of that. He came to fulfill it. And if you really take a look at Jesus' life, Jesus was more religious than I would bet anybody, not only in this room, but anybody in Western Christianity. Jesus would be the most religious guy on the block. You know, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, we had a Jewish friend from England who came to live with us for about 4 months. And his name was Shmulek, which is really Hebrew for Sammy. You know, Samuel, but Sammy, Shmulek. And pick him up at the airport, and I had known him, again, from online, and he came and stayed with us. And it was really difficult to live with him. I remember the first Saturday, the first Sabbath that he was there, I wanted to take him to lunch down in Dana Point Harbor. We had to calculate the mileage from our house to the harbor because he could only go so many miles on the Sabbath or else he would be in violation of the Sabbath. And then once he got there, of course, he had to eat kosher. He had to eat what he could eat. So he had to pick and choose among the menu. And then it turns out he could eat the food within a certain mile radius, but he couldn't pay for it because that would be in violation. I thought that was pretty convenient, yeah? I like that one. So I got to pay for the lunch that he ate. And every aspect of life was changed in our home as he entered it. You know, the Sabbath that starts on 6 o'clock on Friday and ends on 6 o'clock on Saturday, basically sundown to sundown, would start and everything would change for him, you know. In a Hebrew, in a Jewish home, you're not supposed to kindle a fire or do any sort of work. In really Orthodox homes, they interpret that to mean you can't even flip a light switch because that would be kindling a fire. And so they have to leave their lights on. Or some, really fastidious and technologically minded Jews, they have motion sensors on their lights. So on the Sabbath, they can walk into the room and the lights go on by themselves. You light a candle before sundown, and then you don't light it again until sundown on Saturday. You can relight the next candle from the candle before and that sort of thing. But all these things are part of following this law. The Sabbath meal is different. He would set the table a certain way with certain utensils. And when he would prepare the meal for us and we would eat in kosher with him, it changed everything. There were daily prayers 3 times a day that he would say religiously. He even brought his accoutrements with him, what you want to call them. He had his tallit, his prayer shawl with the fringes, the tzitzits on them, and he would cover his head when he would pray 3 times a day. And he's not even a rabbinical Jew. He considers himself a Talmudic Jew, which means that he's following Jesus as he believed the first Jewish followers of Jesus did, which means he's only following the 613 written laws, but not all of the oral tradition, which numbered in the thousands of extra laws that the rabbis put on the people. Only a fraction is what he's following there. In the first century, when Jesus was walking around with his friends and the temple still stood, there were 3 pilgrimage festivals that had to be attended. There were Pesach or Passover or Shavuot, which was weeks, and Sukkot, which was the Feast of Tabernacles. And wherever you were, you needed to go to temple and present yourself and your sacrifice to God. Jesus did this assiduously. Jesus never missed a pilgrimage festival. He followed kosher. He followed the dietary laws. He followed the cleanliness and purification laws. He went to the pilgrimage festivals. We think we know Jesus. We imagine him like ourselves. In fact, since the 70s and the late 60s and the Jesus movement, you know, we imagine Jesus as the original hippie, you know, with the long hair and the beard and cool guy and all of that and brotherly love, peace out. if we really had met Jesus as he was, he would have appeared so alien to us. Not with long hair, but with the close-cropped hair and close-cropped beard that was prevalent in Palestine at the time, wearing his traditional garb. When we are coming face-to-face with the Orthodox Jews that live either in Israel or in our own country, and they seem so alien to us, you know, with their garb, with their robes, with their hair curls, with the phylacteries. Jesus would have worn the phylacteries on his forehead and on his right forearm. We realize just how religious he was. All these things he followed since he was a boy, since he was bar mitzvahed as a youth and brought into manhood and became responsible for the law. And he never failed these things. He never worked outside his Judaism. But what he was trying to do was to purify his religion, take it back to the beginning. Because what had happened is they were following rules and had lost the meaning behind the rules. They were following the rules as if those rules were the salvation that they sought and forgot about the relationship behind them. And so we need to be careful when we talk about Jesus and we talk about him wanting to abolish the law, abolish religion. He was trying to fulfill it in a very different way. And yet, when we move now to this next one, this next passage, Matthew 6, 5 to 8, it seems like he's going in the other direction. He says, when you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand up and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they may be seen by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their own reward in full. But when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. So do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. So, first Jesus is saying, practice your religion. You know, I didn't come to abolish it. Move into this corporate expression of faith. Fulfill it from within. Now it seems like he's saying, retreat from that. Don't pray in public. There was an article about 3 or 4 years ago by a prominent history professor at Northwestern who took this verse and he interpreted it to mean that Jesus was the first proponent of the separation of church and state. That Jesus would not have approved a public prayer in schools or in the public venue or anything. And as soon as he does that, he is completely misunderstanding what Judaism was about. To the Jew, everything was theological. To the Jew, everything was infused with the awareness of their God. For a Jew to separate God from the public square in any way would be abomination. They could not conceive of such a thing. This is not Jesus' intention here. But what he is talking about is exactly what the young man was talking about in his poem. The Pharisees of his day would make a show of their prayer in order to show everybody how pious they were, to move up the social ladder because of their piety and because of their good works. And Jesus is saying, no, that's not what this is about. Something needs to happen in the other direction. Something needs to happen from the inside out. We have talked in here so much about the difference between conformance and transformance. That to be conformed is an outside in. It's simply obedience, trying to, as the poet says, behave or modify yourself. And transformance comes from the inside out, and that's what Jesus is all about. But Jesus is saying something deeper here as well. We talk about Christianity as not being a religion, but being a relationship. Have you heard that one before? But what Jesus is telling us is that the relationship that we have with him, the relationship we have with our Father God, has no meaning outside of the community in which it's practiced. We forget that the ancient Hebrews were a communal people. Everything that they did was in relation to each other, in relationship to the community. They didn't conceive of this rugged individuality, of practicing your faith, your spirituality, apart from community. It would have no meaning to them without the context of the community, of the group, of the religious practice. We're so geared to the individual that we miss the context. This relationship Jesus is talking about, this relationship that we so treasure, that he really was pioneering with the idea of Abba, his father, his daddy, is only meaningful as an experience within the group, the corporate experience lived out in religious practice. What Jesus is saying is that these structures, these practices are necessary. They're necessary. And how does he put that? Look at Matthew 5:18. Again. Truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Now, when we read that, we think about the end of the world, don't we? We think about the end of all times when the earth ends and that sort of thing, and the law is going to stay in place. But when you break that down in the Aramaic language that Jesus first delivered it, we find that Shemaya, what we translate as heaven, is the place of unity, the place of connection. It's God's abode in the sense that it's oneness and unity, not separate things. And Ara, earth, is a place of individual form, individual structure. The Jews understood that we as human beings live between heaven and earth, capable of both the unity, but also living in the individuality as we live and breathe in our individual bodies. And this idea of nemosa, the law, not a legal instrument, but a guide, a help, a thing of beauty that relieves the weakness in each of us as human beings and guides us into this unity that is who God is. And the most fascinating thing to me, this word abar, to pass away, we think of it just as ending. But what it really means is in the same sense when we talk about a person passing away. It's a crossing of a boundary. It's a going beyond a limit. And so, literally, when heaven and earth, not end, but when heaven and earth cross boundaries, merge together as one, then the law will pass away as well. But until that happens, the law is absolutely necessary. For all of us as human beings, as long as we are living between heaven and earth, there is a need for these religious structures. What does religion do for us? Think about it. Religion is the discipline. It is the structure that orders our lives. It orders our societies. It orders and structures our spiritual journey. Thomas Keating famously said that the spiritual life doesn't have to be felt, but it does have to be practiced. How are we practicing our spiritual life? We can say we don't have to go to church on Sunday, and that's absolutely right. That's not a prerequisite. But if you're not going to church on Sunday, what are you doing? How are you getting up and showing up and practicing your spirituality? The group gives us that opportunity to do that. The group gives us structure when we are too weak to give the structure to ourselves. It's an important part of our lives together. But it needs to be tempered with that relationship, with that inside-out direction to our spirituality. There is a psychological school of thought called cognitive behavioral therapy. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Sometimes an offshoot of that is reality therapy or choice therapy. And basically what it says is that all human behavior is broken into four categories: thinking, acting, feeling, and your physiology. So you got these four things that you can do. Of those four, there's only two that you have any control over, and that's the first two. You have a choice about how you think, and you have a choice about how you act. Nothing you can do about your feelings. You know, you feel a certain way, don't try to change them. That's impossible. You know. And your physiology, of course. But there is a connection between the two. As you think, so you act, and as you act, so you feel. Right? And as you feel, that drives your physiology. when we are acting or when we are feeling so negatively and all of our anxiety is ramped up, the chemical changes that occur in us is driving all sorts of negative physiology. Now, there's a debate going on. Is the first thing that you change as you want to change the way that you live your thoughts or your actions? In other words, do you think your way into right acting or do you act your way into right thinking? And everybody fights over that, just like they fight over these religious issues. And I think the main flaw in our thinking, the main flaw in the thinking of this poem that we read at the beginning, is not with a stated premise, but with the underlying assumption that it's either or, and not both and. God is one. God is unity. It becomes a chicken and egg thing, a horse and cart thing. Sometimes we can, with a new concept, reorder the way that we act. And sometimes we need to just start acting so that we can have new experience that gives us a new way of thinking. The two work hand in glove. We can come at things from both sides at the same time. The Jews were so specific about God's unity, God's oneness. Their main prayer, the Shema, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, means, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. That oneness, seeing things as a single entity, seeing religion as part of the way that we act our way into right thinking, and seeing our relationship as a way that we can get a concept that will also change our behavior. Both things work together as one. And we need to see that flopping down to one side or another is damaging to the very goals that we seek. About 300 years after Jesus, there was a movement called the Desert Fathers and Mothers, where these people trying to find this spirituality that we're talking about fled the towns and villages, especially the Eastern Mediterranean, and went out into the deserts, went out in to find their silence and to find this connection. And one of the stories that comes from this tradition was of a monk walking down a road with a young acolyte, a young person who was learning from him, his Padawan learner, if you will. And as they're walking down the street, a young man comes to him and says, Father, to the old monk, he says, tell me how I can get closer to the Lord. And he says, I think you need to enjoy yourself a little less. And he goes on, and an old man comes to him and says, Father, tell me how I can get closer to the Lord. He says, I think you need to enjoy yourself more. Live it up. You know, smell the roses. And then he goes on. And the young acolyte says to him, you know, Father, I think maybe you don't know what you're talking about. You told one to enjoy yourself less and the other enjoy yourself more. And the old man says to him, the spiritual path is like a bridge without rails over the abyss. When I see someone veering off to the left, I tell them right a little bit. If they're veering off to the right, I say left a little bit. The middle way is the true way. We've said in here before, the truth is not at the extremes. The truth is the synthesis of the extremes into the middle. Jesus is always trying to gather the edges into the middle, into himself, to bring things together. That's why when we debate, we are going against everything that the spiritual journey is about. Because a debate, by definition, separates, divides, inflames the passions, puts us against each other. And when we view these things, religion bad, relationship good, you know, this bad, this good, and we separate these things, we are working against everything that God is about. God is unity, echad. Separation is sin. Hataha. The quality of the means that we use must match the quality of the ends that we seek, or we will never get there. I've been trying to pound that one in over the last few weeks. If we are going to work for unity, we must first be unified. Well, what if we're not? Well, then act as if you are. That's acting into right thinking. We must choose as if certain things are true if we are ever going to get where we need to go. And we need to use the tools that God has given us. And religion, properly understood and properly used, is one of those tools. It can guide us. It can structure us. It can discipline us. But just like a symbol without the truth behind it becomes meaningless, the ritual without the sanctification from within is equally meaningless. A sacrament is only the outward expression of an inward transformation. If we don't bring the transformation, everything becomes meaningless. It's both and. It's bringing things together. And until we realize this, we will always be in needless confrontation, needless division. So here's the irony that I see. That as long as we see no need for religion and no need for law, we really do need it. As long as we think that we can separate these things out, as long as heaven and earth are still operating in separate spheres, then the law is absolutely necessary. But as soon as we realize that they are one and the same, then we can let go. Then they can pass away as heaven and earth have crossed boundaries and become one in our lives. This is kingdom. This is where Jesus is taking us. So yes, we can practice our religion with full-throated enthusiasm as long as we realize that it's the relationship at the core that sanctifies it. Let's pray. Father, thank you for questioning 17-year-olds. Thank you for on-fire 20-year-olds who raise the questions that we should all be asking, who point out to us that the emperor has no clothes at times. Thank you for anything that gets us talking about you, thinking about you, becoming more aware of your presence in our lives. These are the things that will grow us up and mature us. Help us not to be afraid of them. Help us not to be afraid of being led into error. If our goal is you and we're working in unity for you, you have promised that we'll find you. We want to take that one to the bank. Thank you, Father, for everything that you've given us to guide us and to bring us back to yourself. Help us see these things as sacred structures in our lives and use them to find you more deeply every moment. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.